Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help.
When I was young, was so much younger.
Hello and welcome to what, as you know, I promise, will be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, and of course, just across the way, a force to be reckoned with, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Darn right, Billy.
George, is there anyone in this world that isn't mad at you?
How much time do I have to think about this?
Well, I'll take as much time as you need, pal.
You're not, are you?
No, not currently.
Okay,
I'm not.
So I just
answered.
I'm
a little mad.
Okay.
I mean, you wore the Toronto Maple Leaf shirt in today. This is an American show.
It's one of my best.
Maple Leafs?
Yeah. I suppose with all the tariff stuff, I shouldn't have done it. I should have worn the Blackhawks.
You should have worn Blackhawks. But nice to see you. Nice to have you here. And
yeah,
we've got a great show tonight. In studio, we've got Julia and Alex, and they've got quite a story to tell, and we can't wait to get to it. But before we do, George, you know we love to talk about a step, a real recovery. So let's talk about step one.
Well, step one is we admitted we were powerless over drugs and alcohol and that our lives are unmanageable. But the reason we do the steps on this show is to help us with our walk with Jesus. And the reason we did this show is there's a lot of people that are in recovery that don't have the Lord. And our Bibles say that it's appointed once to man to die and then the judgment. I need Jesus. And we see a lot of people that have done great work and they're doing service work and they're helping others, but they don't have the Lord. So it's, if you are an addict, you're really practicing idolatry. But if you're in recovery without Jesus, that's still idolatry. And what we want to talk to you about is God loves you. He has a plan for you. And what we're going to hear tonight is probably a very tough story at the beginning, but God is victorious in the end. We have real people with real problems, and we have a real God. And that's what we want to talk about, Bill. And what step one does is I'm powerless over everything. I'm powerless over you, the show. My next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. So it's not just about being powerless over drugs and alcohol.
George, does step one challenge this? Because a lot of people say, I have this under control. That's the lie we often tell ourselves. I've got this. Doesn't step one challenge that?
I believe it does. And I think it also, if we look at the end of it, that our life is unmanageable. The reason it's unmanageable is I'm trying to run it. And any time anything happens that God allows, and if he's sovereign, he allows everything in the world, I'm judging God for what he allowed. And what I'm going with this is I want to get out of being God myself. I want to get out of judging you and other people and play my role. And if I have it, I think the reason we get into addiction in the first place is we are our own gods. I think it starts with the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. And any time I choose to sin, which I do often, I choose to obey George instead of God.
So if we are doing step one admitting we're powerless, that means each day we need to turn over control of our lives to God's care.
Right.
And that's something we should happily do every day.
Well, yeah.
And why wouldn't you want to?
Yeah, I know, but we're pretty competent, and I think that's where the rub comes in. I mean, Bill, when I say I'm turning my life over to God, he kind of has it anyway, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I'm kind of stopped fighting him and getting to walking with him. How do you see step one in your life? Because I know you work these steps, about being powerless, and
well,
how do you start your day out?
I see it more as I am a broken sinner that God will forgive and has forgiven and will continue to forgive, and I need to just submit to that.
How do you do that? I mean, I know you start with the Word.
Start with the Word, and then every time you're confronted with a choice to be led by the Spirit or led by the flesh, there's that instantaneous fork in the road, and I think my brain instantly knows I'm at a fork, and I get to pick.
Okay.
And so, I know what it's like when I choose flesh, and I know what it's like when I choose the Spirit.
Okay, so you don't only admit that you're powerless. I think the key for all of us is to accept that. And how I accept that is my actions. Jesus said you have to pick up your cross and deny yourself daily. We have what we call non-essentials to our recovery and our walk. I need to pray. I pray before I get out of bed to stay sober, because ever since I've been doing that, it works. get into the Word. And, Bill, we talk about these non-negotiables that we have for our recovery. If you really believe in step one, if you admit it, you need to accept it. And how does that walk out in your life? And for a lot of people, it's going to treatment. It's admitting you have a problem. Okay, I know I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm an addict. What am I going to do with that?
Well, if you have a problem that doesn't require the cross of Jesus Christ, maybe you have not diagnosed the problem correctly.
I like that. Can you explain a little bit?
Well, every problem in this life has an answer, and that's the cross of Jesus Christ. And if you think you've got a problem that doesn't require the cross, maybe you haven't diagnosed this correctly. Maybe you have not said, I have not figured this out because I still think I can do something. I still think I have the power to overcome something on my own apart from the power of God. So maybe you don't have this thing figured out.
I like that. Yeah. Very good. I think we try to be our own savior sometimes, in other words, right?
Totally.
And I think trying to be our own God got us in here in the first place. I'm going to make all my decisions. I'm going to do what I want to do. And I think when you get the gift of desperation that you're beaten up and up to, one of the recovery books talks about being in a state of reasonableness. You realize, I'm going to let God be God, and George is going to be George, and we're going to go from there. What we're going to talk about a little bit tonight, too, is not just being powerless over ourselves, our drugs, but other people we love and circumstances. And it gets really hard when you love people and you see them destroying themselves. And Bill, we've been to a lot of funerals, and it's the real deal. It's what we're playing for. Is eternity with Jesus, but a lot of hard things happen along the way. And we're going to talk about that tonight.
Mm-hmm. George, in Romans chapter 10, verse 9, it says that if you confess with your mouth Jesus as Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. And I know there's a lot of people listening tonight that are tired. You've had a really hard time letting go of things. And letting your worries and the anxieties of life, giving them over to God. So you want to hold on to those. You wrestle with them. You try to take them back. You say, I'll give them to God, but then you take them back. And you're in this constant ping pong match with yourself thinking, well, one minute I feel like I can surrender and the next minute I better go get those problems back and control them myself. I think that's the daily realizing that you're powerless over this. You've got to give it to God, period, end of sentence, full stop. There you go. Now you say something.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think the process, we have to go through what we go through until we use all our resources. Because I do have this until God allows me to go my own way and be broken. And then, you know, the prodigal son says that his father saw him a long way off and ran to him and said, this is my son who was dead. And now he's alive, and God does that. And when we reach out, he's there. I think, Bill, when we get into this story, though, we can see people doing everything right, but one of the people that they love is really struggling, and they can't get it. And we see that. I know you see it every Friday night where you go speak at the Salvation Army, and you see guys that had graduated, done really well, mm-hmm. and now they're back. So this is the real deal.
And I find that to be so heartbreaking because they stacked up a bunch of sobriety. They also grew in their faith. So I guess I'm brought back to the idea that the enemy is very patient and will wait for any opportunity to get a foothold once again to create as much pain and discouragement and despair as possible. And that's an easy out for a lot of people, just to change the way they feel, to go back to what they were doing, to try to get a little bit of that comfort they once had.
Yeah, it's real easy to go back. Mm-hmm. I think most people underestimate what it takes to stay sober and walk the new life. And so what we're going to look about tonight is we're going to talk to Julia and Alex, Bill. And I wanted to bring Julia on. I know we have a little bit before we go to break. But Julia, welcome to the program. I know you're a pastor here in town. Mm-hmm. I know you were a corporate person before that. But what we're going to talk about, can you tell us a little bit how you're involved in the story tonight?
Yeah, sure. I was 17 when Alex was born. I still remember the day and looked into his precious face and loved him from the moment he was born. And then I moved away when I went to college and things like that. And so we'd just see him at holidays. People said he was the male version of me. We looked a lot alike. And so always had a real fond feeling for him, but wasn't close to him as I went into my adult life. And several years ago, and I was hearing from my sister that he had gotten into drugs and was not in a good place. And several years ago, I went back to our hometown and saw him, and my heart was just broken. He looked so unhealthy. I hadn't seen him in a couple years, and the first thing he asked me for was money, and couldn't look me in the eye. And I just came back and just wept, and but didn't think I could do anything. And I've been involved in several churches. I'm at Hosanna now, and we're involved with Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. And it kept coming to mind, and I kept pushing it away, going, no, he wasn't raised in a Christian environment. There's no way this is going to happen. No. Kept ignoring it, kept pushing it, and didn't go away. And then I went to the gala for Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, and I was watching the singers, and I kept picturing his face. And then a young man walked out on the stage, and he said, "Hi, my name is Alex." And
whoa.
I went, "Okay, God, I'm hearing you." And so my husband was driving home, and I can finish up in a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. The table is set. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to start the story of Julie and Alex. Thanks for listening to Real Recovery tonight. We're awfully glad you're listening. We'll take a very short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. Awfully glad you're listening tonight. Real Recovery is alive and well. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, and just across the way, George Fraser, a man who likes anybody who lavishes praise on him. George, we got a big story tonight. Well, it's true.
Yeah.
No, it's totally true. I speak the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, right before we went to break, Julia started the story, and it was riveting.
Yeah. We had to cut her off.
I know. I had to do that, but we had a break to go to, but now we're back, so...
Well, we recap it. You know, she had a little incident with one of her family members, and she was really concerned and worried, and I believe felt very powerless about what to do. She's a minister at a very large church, walking with the Lord, and her nephew has a problem with drugs. And you went to the Teen Challenge banquet. What happened then?
Yeah, it was funny. I kept crying as I was watching all the faces singing, and I kept picturing Alex up there. And then a young man walked out, and he said, "Hi, my name is Alex." And I knew it was the Holy Spirit saying, "This is me. I'm telling you to reach out to him." So my husband and I were driving home. He was driving, so I could text. And I sent a text to Alex, and I just said, "Alex, I love you. I have always loved you. I will always love you, and I don't want you to die." And I just said, "If and when you are ready for a change, you call me. I will come get you. I will take you. There's a place called Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. We'll do what we can to get you in there." And I didn't expect to hear anything back. I just went, "Okay, God, I did what I was supposed to do, and now it's up to you." And a couple of weeks later, my sister called and said, "Alex keeps talking about Minnesota and you." And I thought, "Oh, no, what have I gotten myself into?" was my first reaction. And then Alex reached out, and he said, "I want to come." And I said, "Okay, we'll figure this out."
Julie, where was Alex living at the time?
He was in Wisconsin, Oconomowoc.
Okay.
And so I didn't even know if it was going to be possible to get him into the program. I just was responding to what I felt God telling me to do. And so there were a lot of different things that had to happen, a lot of different people coming together, figuring it out. And then they said, "We're going to be able to do this." And so we brought him up, and we got him in the program. I didn't see him for the first week. And then as soon as there was a visiting hour, I went down to see him. And, oh, my goodness, what are you, Alex, 6'3", and he was probably, 140 pounds, something like
maybe,
that?
Maybe, if that.
He looked pretty gaunt. He was going through withdrawal. But he looked at me, and he said, "Aunt Julia, you know how much I love my sons." And I said, "Yep." And he said, "I had no idea that God loved me that much." And I looked at him and went, "Okay, God, you're up to something big." And it was not an easy journey. There were setbacks. It was me holding my breath. It was me trusting God and not wanting to take over and rescue him, which is what I would love to do. But surrendering him to God over and over again. But I got to watch a miraculous transformation that started with withdrawals and getting rid of the drugs and the alcohol, but then I got to watch the heart and the mind begin to change as Jesus was in his life. It was unbelievable.
How different is it to, I know you work with a lot of people and you counsel people.
Yeah.
When it's in your family and it's close, how much different is that?
It's hard because I know him too well, and I know the decades of addictive thinking and the ability, you know, living a life where you manipulate people. And so, and really, I hadn't known him as an adult. And so he and I would have hard conversations, and I'd say, do not manipulate me. And he'd go, okay, I won't. And we had to figure out even how do we have a relationship when he's my nephew, but I'm also not going to be played by the addict mindset. So it was not easy. You know, you go back and forth. Again, you want to run in and rescue.
Sure.
And yet then you have to back up, and you also have another life of your own, and so you can't take over and spend all of it with him. So it was not easy.
When we get asked a lot from people, parents, or, you know, our friends that have kids, what do I do? You know, I put some big boundaries up. I always tell people, the tough love is good, but sometimes you got a choice. Do you want your kid dying in your basement or out on the street?
Right.
How was that for you?
You know, it was a challenge. And this is where I had to trust that God was going to lead me, mm-hmm. because there were times that I had to back up, and then there were times that I had to press in. There were times that my husband and I had to look at each other and go, okay, if Alex falls out of the program, do I let him be on the street? Do we bring him in the house? What do we do? And so even between my husband and me, it was having to figure that out.
Okay.
I felt day by day that God would show me. I got a phone call from Alex at one point saying, I'm leaving the program. This was fairly early on.
I had actually left the program.
Yeah, he had left it. And
a thought that occurs to everyone in there.
Yes, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness. And so I couldn't find him. And then finally I got a call from a strange number saying, I'm at the park across the street. And I said, stay there, I'm coming. And he got in the car and we drove, and I just drove in circles and just said, talk to me. What is going on? And he was angry. He was frustrated. And then the tears began to come. And he was confused by some of the things they were asking, and having almost flashbacks to when he was caught between the police and drug dealers and things like that. And so walking through and saying, Alex, this is different. This is different than when you were out on the street. And then calling Teen Challenge and saying, are you willing to talk to him again? And they do tough love really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't know what was going to happen. And when he walked back in, they all clapped and cheered, and I cried and said, okay, we're here for another day. And
cool.
That's what it was.
That's
one
great.
One day at a time.
I would like to stop there, Julia, mm-hmm. and get Alex's story up to this point, Billy.
Yeah.
And so, Alex, you're from Wisconsin, somebody that parties too much from Wisconsin. I don't think we've ever had that on the show before, have we, Billy?
It's a first.
It is a first,
Wisconsin.
Yeah. And so, how old were you when you started using?
You know, that's always a tough one for me. My timeline is just so messed up from using for so long. I know I started smoking cigarettes personally when I was like six or something like that, to tell you the truth. But I didn't really start using drugs, so to speak. I think I smoked pot for my first time in eighth grade, I believe. And then it just snowballed from there. It was a lot of social drugs, and then eventually it really just became a more isolated issue. The truth, when it became drugs, painkillers is really what took me down. I'd fallen off a roof, shattered my wrist, and my life had fallen apart prior to that. So really, mm-hmm. I started taking the painkillers for the emotional pain, not the physical pain, and that's when it got really bad.
You got hooked pretty quickly on those?
Yeah, it totally threw me, because I'd been used to doing, trying ecstasy, stuff like that. So I had no idea how crippling it was going to be addicted to opiates, to actually have you physically need it or you're sick and you can't function.
Okay.
It was a miserable, miserable experience.
So at first, drugs are kind of fun, aren't they?
Yeah.
And, you know, hear all these bad things and all that, and it really doesn't happen, and they're recreational, they change how we feel.
Right.
I think of that verse, Bill, Satan roars around like a lion looking for somebody to devour. We get away from the pack a little bit like a wild animal, and he comes in, and the next thing you know, you're hooked.
Right.
So you were an adult when you fell off the roof, I'm assuming.
Yep. I was 21 years old. I had a new baby and a new boy. He was less than a year old, a new family.
Okay.
And, yeah. Fell off the roof. It was my roofing business. So I basically had to shut down my business because I couldn't work anymore. And I lost basically everything I had built in a matter of like a week. And it just, it felt horrible. I felt like I couldn't even take care of my family anymore. So my wife, who previously didn't have to work, now had to go get a job. And yeah, I felt like I just didn't have any purpose anymore. You know, it's terrible.
And you got a prescription from, you know,
doctor,
it's medical, right?
You know,
so this is good.
Yeah.
It's actually good to get the government to pay for if you have health insurance to pay for your drugs.
Yeah, a dollar a month.
So it kind of works. And then all of a sudden, what I wanted to get out of pain, this solves my emotional pain.
Right.
How quickly on those were you hooked, do you think?
Within a couple prescriptions, you know, within probably faster than I even know because I'd been taking them regularly. So I didn't get I didn't experience actually being off them until I had actually, I wasn't really doing any other drugs because that's just all I needed at that point. And, somebody had come around with a little bit of cocaine, and I had one little line of cocaine, and I failed a UA, and they wouldn't give me my prescriptions anymore. And then I was just sick, and somebody I know was like, have you ever tried heroin? And that's when it turned to heroin.
Okay, that's a big leap.
Yeah.
And once we get into heroin, we're going to get a physical addiction.
Yeah.
So now when you get up in the morning, your first thought is, I got to get some. How am I going to get it?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So how did that change your lifestyle?
Well, the physical addiction, it actually started even with the pills, to tell
you
the truth. And that's why I jumped to heroin is because I couldn't
stand
being sick.
Yeah.
So my whole life changed. I needed to think and prepare to make sure I had something for the morning so I could function. I've always just done like trade skills, drywall, landscaping, whatever needs to be done. And the scary thing is a lot of people like knew that I was a wretched addict. But they also knew I did good work, so they'd still hire me, you know, and it was, but I'd have to actually prepare myself and I'd have to make sure I had something in the morning so that I could get up and I could function and work.
All right.
Quickly.
Yeah. Let's take a break, George, because I think this is a good time. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Alex and Julia. This is quite fascinating, George. That's the addiction process happens so fast and you think that you've got time, but you don't. I think that's one of the lies, that you can either experiment or take it for a short amount of time, but you, truth is, you can't.
No, and what I'm, you know, feeling in here is the sadness, the destruction. We normally just focus on one side of the issue, and tonight we're two, that I have people in my life that I'm affecting negatively. I'm not doing it to hurt them, but there's collateral damage here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going down emotionally. There's shame, and there's people that are worried to death about me because I'm in a free fall.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of love in the room in the studio tonight. We're going to continue our discussions with Julia and Alex in just a minute. You're listening to Real Recovery. Awfully glad you're with us tonight. We'll take a short break and be right back.
Did.
I know I just did, but I didn't want to.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, but we're back. We can't waste any more time. Welcome back to Real Recovery. I should say welcome us back because you didn't go anywhere. You were waiting for us to return, but so we're back now. And Bill Arnold, George Fraser. George is not a man who lives in the past, but he doesn't, he insists I bring up when he was 9 years old, he won the punt, pass, and kick competition. I don't know. He likes me
For Edina.
So he likes me mentioning that, even though he does not live in the past.
I might have peaked a little early.
I'm just saying. I just want to make it clear to the listeners. You are forging ahead. You don't live in the past, but you do insist I bring that up.
Yeah, thank you. You know, fascinating story tonight. And we get to watch this face-to-face. You get to listen to it on the radio. God, I'm seeing behind the scenes that we don't see it at the time, what's going on. And we're going to get to that, and we're going to look at it through the rearview mirror, Bill, and see how great and awesome God is and how we underestimate him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to get back here to Alex. So you have fallen off the roof. You've gotten a prescription for opioids. It runs out. So you go and get some heroin. You're still working, but this has become priority one. Now, you're married at the time, and you have a new baby. How does this progress for you?
I actually hadn't even gotten on heroin until after my divorce, to tell you the truth. I'd originally gotten on pills, and then I got off of them. I had them for the surgery originally, and that was it. And I got off them, and I actually kind of stayed clean for a little while, to tell you the truth. And then life just didn't get easier. You know, I remember in the past I had gotten sober a couple times, and like that's all I needed to do was get sober, and then I could handle it. But I think things had gotten so far off track, I didn't know how to live like a normal person anymore. So getting sober, things didn't get easier at all. And having lost and have to rebuild and everything, I just got really depressed. And I wound up actually going back to a pain specialist for post-traumatic surgical arthritis and got a huge prescription for opiates, and that's when things really developed from there.
I want to ask you a question about post-surgical arthritis. Mm-hmm. Legit?
Yeah, but not as bad as I definitely didn't need what they were giving me.
Okay.
That's for sure.
Your scoreboard lit up when they prescribed opiates.
Right. I was like, okay, cool.
Like, what did they prescribe?
It was 430 milligram oxycodone a day.
Okay. I never took that. Is that enough to light the candle for you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a pretty heavy amount. Comparably, it would be
But you were in a lot of pain, right?
Yeah, Not that much pain, though, that's for sure. Physically, not as much as emotionally.
Okay.
I was really hurting inside.
How long were you able to run that prescription?
Probably 7 months or so.
Okay.
Until they wouldn't fill it for me anymore.
What happened then?
What happened then? Like, why did they wouldn't fill it anymore?
Well, I get why they don't. Yeah, I'm an addict. I don't understand this.
No,
yeah.
I just,
and they've gotten really tight about doctor shopping and pharmacy
and
shopping, right?
When this all happened was when there wasn't any restriction on it.
Oh.
It was just being handed out like crazy, which is why they gave me a huge amount of oxycodone. I mean, it's comparable to maybe $40 worth of heroin a day is what I was getting from the doctor.
Okay.
So, yeah. Scary to think it that way, but that's how it was. My life really became, you know, it was always unmanageable. I just thought I could manage it. I think you said something more about that earlier, is I always thought I was in control, and I never really was, you know. It was always just trying to get by, just trying to make it through the day is what it became. It was just treading water basically all the time. And that's what my life became about. And meanwhile, I have two children that are being raised by my mother. You know, it wasn't even so much like, you know, I'm the center of my life. It's that I didn't care. You know, when you get into treatment and they start talking about how people who are addicts are narcissistic, it's like, how are you narcissistic when I don't even like myself? Like, I don't care about anybody or anything. Idolatry is what you had said. I mean, it's drugs were my God at that point. That's all I needed, you know. I went to him originally because I had some pain in my heart, you know, and I needed a solution. I turned to drugs instead, and it just devoured me. So,
yeah.
And simultaneously, the boy's mom was heavily into drugs, and so my sister was raising the boys, and so it's a whole web of sadness.
You know, one of the things that scares me a lot is that my children were raised by two addicts for quite a long time. That's what they know is that kind of behavior, and they see it as normal. And they're 11 and 14, wonderful kids, but they also display a lot of the behaviors of an addict without using, because that's what they were raised around. So it scares me to see them acting like that, because it's kind of like that whole dry drunk kind of thing when you hear it, but they've never even used. As an addict, there was a lot of times when you talked about manipulation, it's just second nature. I always used to say, like, as an addict, you tell yourself the best lies. If you can convince yourself that your own BS is the truth, you can sell it to anybody. So you don't even notice half the time when you're doing it. And because it becomes so second nature, that's what I taught my kids for so long. And that's my fault. So now I'm really having a challenge being a new father, you know, after 6 years of having them not live with me, trying to get it right and trying to repair damages that I instilled in them. So,
So I agree with everything you say, and I think when we get to the end, we're going to see that you have a legacy to show them about how you pick yourself up and get in recovery. But we'll get to that, because they do do model us, you know, what we see. And the part about lying, that's real hard for me today, 30 years into recovery, because I'm so good at it. You know, it happens automatically.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we're rewarded for that. I was a sales guy, you know, what do you need? I'll get it for you, right? A legitimate sales guy, not drugs. But so we get to Teen Challenge. You leave. Why did you leave?
That's a tough one, actually. I got put in a situation where I had to talk about somebody else's wrongdoing, basically. And I've never had a hard time admitting when I screw up. You know, and it actually kind of caused issues for me in the program, because I'd make a mistake and they'd be like, every time you make a mistake, you're just like, yeah, I did it, so let's move on. But realistically, that's kind of like, what else do? You pick yourself up and you keep going, you know? So it was a situation where I was being held, and I had to talk about somebody else's wrongdoing, and I didn't want to do it. It felt like it wasn't my place, you know?
Okay.
So, that was a really tough one to be in. I guess it comes down to that whole, like, being a snitch kind of thing that people talk about or something. And it's, I just didn't want to, I felt fine being like, this is my portion. I'll talk about me.
Okay.
You know, so, and I wound up walking out of the program because of it.
Why did she call Julia, or did she call you?
The only person I know in Minnesota. I'd been to Minnesota once in my life before I came to Teen Challenge. So it's I had no resources. I had nobody out here. You know, I was prepared to go to the Salvation Army. But
it's a little drastic.
Right.
Doing that.
Right.
I used to work there.
So. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't have a choir there, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Oh man, I missed the choir though. That was fun.
Okay.
You know.
Why'd you go back? You're out there. What was? Can you remember what you felt like when you're out there? Hey, I left this place. I don't know anybody. I got nothing going. I know I'm an addict. I'm gonna need some more drugs.
You know, is that. That desperation that brought me there in the first place, I mean, and my Aunt Julia, I always call her just Aunt Julia, had said she, you know, felt the calling to call me to come to Minnesota. And when she sent me the text, I was like, sure. You know, I didn't even know about, I'd never heard of Teen Challenge before in my life. I actually went to church more in my first week of Teen Challenge than I did my entire life leading up to it.
Did you get saved there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't know what else to do. It was that whole desperation point where it's like, I just know I'm either going to die or be miserable the rest of my life. And leading up to Teen Challenge, I believed in God just enough to not say I don't believe in God, just in case I was wrong.
Okay.
That was about the extent of it. And I didn't know. I knew all my decision-making was just so soured at that point. I was just going to do what people I know love me tell me to do. And just keep going from there. So that's essentially what I did. I just dropped everything, and I moved to Minnesota and checked into Teen Challenge. And
you leave, you call Julia, she picks you up, talks you into going back.
Right.
What was different once you got back in?
It was still, honestly, I don't know how much I could even say it was different. I just was back on track again.
Okay.
You know, I didn't... When I left the program, I knew it was such a mistake immediately, because this is where I was getting all of my direction in my life. This is where things were starting to feel like they made sense again. It's very sheltered there. You know, it's not the real world by any means. You're very controlled. Everything you do has a structure to it, which, you know, it's like raising kids. You have to structure everything. And I guess correcting an addict is kind of the same way. You have to structure everything in their life for a little while. Because you're so used to just free-flying the whole time.
Huh. Alex, you tell me if this is right, but what I remember one of the changes was before you left, you would talk about the brothers and I will get this figured out, all of the other addicts and I. And it was an us-and-them mentality, that the people in authority were not to be trusted. And one of the shifts was all of you are on the same team, that they're for you, that they're not against you, and figuring out who to trust, not just the street people, you know, made a big difference. And learning to trust the authority was a huge shift that you had to work through.
Always is, Billy, right?
Yeah. Let's pick that up after the break. You're listening to Real Recovery. We'll take a very short break and return with Alex and Julia in just a minute.
his head fell behind him as his arm had reached around.
Welcome back to Real Recovery. Awfully glad you're with us tonight. Bill Arnold, George Fraser. George, when Alex was talking about his parents, you know, what you model is what your kids can start to do. He saw that in his kids. I found that interesting. What your parents model to you is what you do today, which begs the question, is that why you never play public golf courses?
I think so.
Okay. That makes sense then.
Actually, that's all I play. My dad was more successful than I was. Well, that's a whole show right there. So,
yeah,
I've kind of tanked the whole family.
We don't have time for that show.
No.
We need a team of people in white coats that would come in and help process that one.
Be a long show.
Yeah, it would be a long show.
You know, this is cool to see this and hear it about how about how God always had this orchestrated to do it. And we get to see it in the rearview mirror. So you went back. You graduated.
Mm-hmm.
How'd your life go from there?
It's had its ups and downs. When you're in the program at Teen Challenge, you are so submersed and just surrounded by the Word and God. You're in chapel all the time. Choir trips. I loved choir trips. You travel all over the state, seeing churches and singing at them and sharing your story. And I loved it. I really did. And I think anybody, even if you're not an addict, should spend a little while at Teen Challenge and just be so wrapped up in it for a little while. It's a very healthy thing. And then when you graduate the program, it's not like that anymore. You have to constantly find your way back again. There's times where I find myself a little too distant, and I serve at my church. But still sometimes I'm like, man, I'm just lacking a little more Jesus in my life right now. And you have to consciously make the decision to go back. And
right, but you know Jesus. I mean, what was it like for you to realize that there was a God, he wasn't mad at you, he loved you enough to sacrifice his life to have a relationship with you, and how did you start processing that and growing in your faith?
The thing I like to say about that is, like, it's crazy to look back on my life and to see where God was there the whole time. There's those instances, like, I flipped and rolled my car one time, and when you're 6 feet in the air looking backwards at cars coming towards you, it's easy to say, like, I need God right now.
Yeah.
But it's all the little stepping stones in life. Prior to that, I'm a woodworker. That's my main thing I like to do is woodworking. Carpenter. And I found myself working for two different woodworking companies that were Christian-based companies before I was even a Christian, one of which was even a ministry involved in helping people get out of prison and stuff. And just to see all those little stepping stones, like, what business did I have working for, surrounded by Christians, you know, and I didn't believe a lick of it at all. And just to look at back at all those little times that he was just there waiting and never pushing too much on me. I mean, you always have people that are a little too pushy sometimes, but the people that really got through to me were the people that just displayed Christianity. You could just see the Jesus in them. And without hearing the word Jesus, because before I was a Christian, the word Jesus just kind of, like, turned me off immediately.
Sure. There's power in that name.
Mm-hmm. Right? There really is. No matter what, you'll get a reaction, whether it's positive or negative. And but the people that just walked it out were the ones that really made a difference in my life and really drew me towards him more. So to actually come into the program and to start and accept it, like, I always told myself, like, how am I going to believe in something I can't see? But then once you accept it, you start to see it. You can actually, I have physical concrete proof in my life. I know it's beyond believing in Christ. I know it's truth. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a difference between truth and belief. That's for sure. There's an author that talks about that too. But that's what really made the difference for me, was all the little stepping stones in life where I could see the evidence of him being in my life the whole time. That really, really changed things for me.
Yeah, you know, we might not listen to it, but we still hear it when people talk about Jesus. It's kind of like at a trial that the attorney might say something, the judge overrules it, the jury still hears it. So, Julie, how was this for you? I'm sure you just didn't drop him off and leave him and never talk to him again.
No, I would go down most weekends. I went down during the visiting hours, and then when he was when he graduated, I was so proud of him, and we were all there cheering and clapping, and then he stepped out, and his boys moved up. How many? 6 months later, something like that. Yep. 8 months later, and I pray for him often. I am a huge cheerleader. There are times that I hold my breath and I look him in the eye and I go, "How are you doing?" Because when I can look him in the eye, I can tell, are you telling the truth or not? It's just one of the, you can see it once you know. And so it's a one day at a time thing. And I absolutely believe in Alex. Bigger than that, I believe Jesus is what he needed and is plenty for what he can do. And I know the life of a recovering addict is not easy. And so we take it one day at a time. So, yeah.
That kind of covers it, doesn't it? You should get a job doing that.
Should
you
I
know?
Try
yeah.
That? Okay.
So you get sober, you graduate, everything's just wonderful forever and ever, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. there's been so many challenges. And a huge thing was when things get, I found myself in a position where I'm a single father. I don't know how to do that. Working more hours than I'm able to work, and then I still, like, when I get home, beyond being a father, I have other responsibilities I still need to do. And to realize, I guess it comes back to, like you had said in the beginning, just the I realized I'm not enough. I can't physically do it. It's not possible. And that was a huge relief on me, was to realize that I'm not capable of doing everything everybody expects of me. And that was finally like a breath of fresh air for me, because I was struggling and I was trying so hard to do it all. And once I realized I can't, it felt really good. There's a lot of relief in realizing that you can't do it. I can't do it alone. So
I can't do it. He can. I'm going to let him.
Amen.
And I heard Alex just say that in a sentence, life is hard. It's just a lot of work unless you're George Fraser. So, I mean, it seems like, you know, you just every day you have to get up and realize what's on your plate and then just go for it and trust God, because that life is hard. And if you've had a history of not being in a rigorous work routine through your addiction, getting back into a rigorous work routine with lots of responsibilities really requires God's assistance and God's dependence. And you can't do it apart from him.
Did you say rigorous work routine?
I didn't mean it for me. I just
wondered. Yeah, we don't hear that a lot in this room.
No, you almost never hear that in this room.
No, you don't. And you never will, listeners. So let's move on.
Maybe we can edit that out of the show.
Yeah, Logan can do that.
Maybe.
Hey, so you had some tragedy after you got out. What happened?
It was actually really close to when I got out. I had 2 weeks left in the program, and I had found out that my children's mother had died with 2 weeks left in the program. And it really, it was so hard to be an entire state away from my children when that was happening. Even though I didn't have them for the 6 years prior to that, we were still close all the time. And there was always, they knew and I always knew that we would be together again. And to not be together when they were hurting that bad was a horrible thing. The last summer before she died, they had really gotten close with her. They spent more time with her than they ever had, which I think was another thing of God just being there, just putting them back together. Like, they got a chance to really get to know her, which there's a lot. She was an addict as well, and she was using, but there was still a lot to learn from her. She was a neat person, very likable, just one of those people you laughed around all the time. And I had 2 weeks left in the program when that had happened, and they gave me an emergency pass. So I got to go be with my kids. And that week went really, really fast. And then I had to come back. And I was actually supposed to transfer my internship at that point, because Teen Challenge had offered me a job. And things weren't set up, and I had another week, and I was like, hey, can I get out of here and go be with my kids again? And originally they weren't going to let me, and I disagreed, but we just came to terms with like, hey, we're going to agree to disagree here. I think you're wrong. I think I should go home. And at that point, I was getting up to get out of the supervisor authority person's office, and I was like, you can still give me a hug. I'm not mad at you. I just disagree with you. And that changed his mind right there, and he let me leave again. He was like, if I do let you go home, how are you going to get there? My mentor was already on his way to pick me up. He drove me an hour into Wisconsin. My mom came and picked me up with my boys, and I spent the next week with them until I came back to do my internship, which was a really tough thing to do once again, leaving my kids. But at that point, we knew that them moving out here was going to happen a lot faster than we had planned on. It's just where they needed to be and where I needed them as well. It was time for us to be back together again. It was a challenge. It still is a challenge, but it's right. So
one of the things we were talking about even as we were driving here was just figuring out a new routine. I mean, this was a year ago almost today that Sherry died. And Alex's boys moved up in March, and so he is figuring out not only now what is it like to be a sober man living with Jesus, but then also now a father again after 6 years, working full-time, supporting his kids, a single dad. You know, there's a lot of complications, but he's being quite amazing. He's learning from his mistakes when he works too much. He's gutter balls and going, okay, kid, that's not working. But it hasn't been that long, and it's day by day, and it's figuring it out. So I'm really proud of him.
This is pretty close to home for you.
Mm-hmm.
How has the journey been for you?
You know, ups and downs, just like Alex said, tears and joys and celebrations and then grieving. I look at his sons, and I have a lot of hope for them because of who their dad is today. I don't think, you know, if Sherry had died a year earlier when Alex was just entering the program, I think it would have been very different because the boys knew they had a strong father who was sober. I think he's a good example that God can do anything. And so I have a lot of hope. I have a lot of passion for working with broken people. Alex isn't the only one in our family that's had prison and had addictions and things like that. And so it
He's
is
not the only
home.
One in the room either.
No,
so,
no, know, that's right.
Broken people. Well, we're all broken,
we
aren't
all
we?
Are.
And
we
I didn't
are.
Mean to interrupt you there, but you kind of, when you know you're working with people, you've got a space, but when it's your family, you're going to get in touch with some of your own issues, aren't you?
You better believe it. I see my addictions. Mine are just a whole lot prettier.
Okay.
You know, that's the reality.
Well, you know, we talked about your wife's name was Sherry.
Yep.
Our addiction doesn't define us, but it sure can kill us.
Yeah.
And it's a day at a time, Bill, and I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm really happy about that God got you back and that you're working with other guys and you went to Teen Challenge. Your relationship is restored, and I hope you keep giving it away so you keep it yourself. And we can't give anything away we don't have, right, Billy?
Amen, George.
Amen.
Yeah. Another absolute award-winning episode. And I want to say thank you in a big way to Julia and Alex for coming in and sharing their story and being as vulnerable as you have been, because these are never easy stories to tell, but God is glorified in it. And I know there's so many listeners, because we hear from them all the time, that say, I was so encouraged by that. You helped me understand how to walk stuff out. And I think we learned a lesson from Alex tonight and from Julia.
Oh, yeah. One of the great privileges of doing this show is I get to feel more about Jesus, learn more about Jesus, and worship him and what he's done in dead people, making them alive again. The power of the resurrection of Christ.
Yeah. Well, George, as you know, that wraps up another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. If you think you would want to pass this on to a friend, go to myfaithradio.com. Go to Real Recovery, and you can send this episode on to anyone you like. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.
Softly now, owe it to the world.